Welcome to Emergency Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren D. Young-Gilman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And as y'all know, we never do this. As a matter of policy, as a matter of practice, we do not do emergency podcasts.
We don't like breaking news. We like to tell the story behind the news.
And we like to keep to our own schedules.
That's right.
But it turns out the Secretary of Defense is resigning. And if anything required an emergency podcast, this was it. So, Merry Christmas, you filthy animals.
It's a one-time thing, guys. Or at least I really hope it's a one-time thing.
Yeah, we don't make a habit of this on any factor. But we figure we owed our dear listeners a little bit of our brilliant insight. And also, we just needed to get together and drink and talk about Whiskey Tango Foxtrot just happened. So, I guess we could start there. What happened? Why did Mattis announce his resignation this week?
Well, Erin, he got very cross, I think. He had some chats with the president on some things, like Syria and maintaining our troops, possibly also maybe other force levels.
In Afghanistan.
Other places like Afghanistan. And they did not see eye to eye, because apparently Mattis believes in respecting our allies and having a positive world order. And the president deserves someone who is more consistent with his beliefs of, I don't know, not respecting allies and destroying the world order.
That certainly was implied by Mattis's resignation letter, which presumably most of our listeners have at least seen tweets about or have seen excerpts of by this point. But it's a lot of shade for a 60-something-year-old man. There's a lot of shade being thrown in that letter. But there's just this underlying question. I mean, did he resign over Syria policy? Did he resign over 2,000 troops in Syria?
I think this is how the Twitters are reacting to this, and it's bothering me a lot. But I think it's more likely that he resigned because of a process error, and that should make us as process Valentines very happy.
We should send him a mug.
That matters. We should send him a mug. That effectively, if you read some of the follow-up stories to the Mattis resignation, that the decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria was made quite abruptly and apparently over the phone with Erdogan. Prime Minister of Turkey. Trump was on the phone with Erdogan, had talking points about a way forward on ISIS and Syria that he completely changed his mind on and just decided in the middle of the phone call that we are going to pull out U.S. troops quite abruptly. And as a result, had, of course, no interagency consultation on this, but also, more importantly, no consultation with any of our coalition of allies, including the Kurds, more importantly, that are fighting and losing battles there. And that, I think, was the last straw for Mattis, that it was a stain on our honor, effectively, to back out of this commitment.
So there's some interesting reporting. I don't know if you guys saw this article in the AP today that kind of gives at least as close to a TikTok, I think, as we're likely to get on that call, which actually took place a week ago. So that took place on December 14th. And Erdogan basically got Trump, if these reports are to be believed, Erdogan basically got Trump onto his back heel almost immediately by saying, ISIS is 99% defeated. What are you guys still doing there? And Trump turned to Bolton, who I guess was in the room on the call, and was like, is that true? I mean, if that's true, what are we still doing there? And they didn't have a good answer.
Well, this to me is a problem of the dumbing down of the advising of the president, the vastly oversimplifying the fact that, once we defeat ISIS, we're fine. And the president has announced that we've defeated ISIS at least a couple of times in the past.
Several times this week.
Right. So far as I can tell, the primary justification that anyone in the Pentagon uses as to why we have troops in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, or anywhere in the Middle East is to say we're there to prevent another 9/11. And it's really a lot more freaking complicated than that. So by oversimplifying, president's pretty well right to ask, what the hell are we still doing there?
Well, and just to be clear, when they say we've defeated ISIS, what they really mean is ISIS's territorial control has gone way down from where it was. That may or may not, depending on which ISIS and /ISI/AQI, various predecessor organizations, scholars believe, may or may not be related to how ISIS's ability to either project high profile attacks and or future capabilities, part A. And part B, they can't really tell the president we're also there to counter the Russians. I mean, he's not into that. So they just left the Russians out. Now, maybe Iran.
Maybe.
He seems to be kind of like meh on that too.
But let's be honest, Radha, you just use a part A and a part B in a discussion with us. We're not using part A's and part B's when they're briefing the president on why we're in Syria at any point in time. And maybe he can't tolerate that, but I think this is coming back to bite them.
So I had speculated earlier in the week when the announcement first came out that it was less about Syria and more about Afghanistan. And so after the resignation letter came out, there was then an announcement, or at least a leak of a discussion, that we're going to withdraw 7,000 troops from Afghanistan, which we don't know exactly how many troops there are there at the moment, but that's roughly half, we think, of the uniformed military personnel who are on the ground there. Maybe these things sort of go together. I think Tammy Wittes, who's been with us on the show a few times, also highlighted that a point that we made a couple weeks ago, maybe it was just even last week, that this also comes on the heels of the president rejecting Secretary Mattis's recommendation for chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So you have a very near-term policy thing with regard to this call with Erdogan, a longer-term policy thing on Afghanistan, and the sort of dismissal or the rejection of recommendation of General Goldfein as the chairman in favor of Mark Milley. These are all things that, I guess, in a normal administration would cause the Secretary of Defense to resign, right? Like, they're not listening to you, so they're going wantonly against your recommendation. Most folks don't stay that long if that's happening.
But here's the thing that bothers me about that. Like, I think you're absolutely right, but the whole point of Mattis was to disagree with the president. Like, the president has
Well, that was our point. Was that ever Trump's point?
I don't know, but it's not as though President Trump's views on Afghanistan, Syria, and alliances overall haven't been a secret for a long time. So for Mattis to, in his resignation letter, highlight that he deserved to have a Secretary of Defense whose views better aligned with him, his views haven't aligned with the president the entire time they've been there. And the value of Mattis has been to a lot of folks on the outside that his views did not align with the president to the degree to which he was shaping the president's views versus constraining and maybe even subverting the president's views is something that I think we should be more concerned about than we are. But, you know, everyone's treating this as a massive surprise, but in terms of like the Syria decision and possibly the Afghanistan decision, I'm just amazed they didn't happen earlier.
Either I'm amazed that it didn't happen earlier, or I'm amazed that it, given that it didn't happen earlier, that it happened now.
Well, that's like, the thing.
I think that's the thing.
And it's also, I'm also a little amazed. I mean, this is the classic, you know, the Defense Department is good at lots and lots of things. One of them is foot dragging. And so they can foot drag their way so that it looks like you don't have options. And that really irritates presidents when they feel boxed in by that. Obama was definitely irritated with the Pentagon on a couple of different occasions because of the way that they kind of bureaucratically created a fait accompli on certain policy options. The Afghanistan surge is probably the best known, but 2011 in Iraq is another one. Here again, we have the president and the president's advisors all kind of aligning to say, no, we need to stay in Syria. We need to stay in Afghanistan. None of this is a surprise. I mean, he campaigned on these issues. He campaigned on, you know, 30 days, a plan for ISIS, and we're out, you know, to get out of the war in Afghanistan. So I guess I am a little surprised that, one, this came as such a shock, but also, two, that there's not somebody didn't have an OPT somewhere that was tasked with planning a contingency for what if the president wakes up one morning and tells everybody to go home. That does not seem like a really improbable set of events.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's likely. I mean, I'm just speculating. It's likely that they have some kind of thing on the books about that. The thing that bothers me about it is that they have not spent the last several months basically creating mitigating work behind the scenes toward that. Sorry, that was a really poorly worded sentence. Let me actually clarify what I mean. That if you know the president's going to ask you to pull out of Syria or Afghanistan at some point in the future and you can't predict when, what are the things you want to get done? And maybe actually that's what we've been doing in Afghanistan. I think it's actually a pretty good indication of the policy there. Syria, I have honestly, like 2 days ago, we were there to get rid of Iran. So like,
and even Erdogan was surprised. I mean, he was like, oh, but don't leave like right now.
I think, you know, Lauren started this off by saying he left on a process point. And I think it's actually a good point because it's not actually clear that, to me at least, that withdrawing troops from Syria is per se a bad policy. It's clear that the way we're doing it here and doing it in this manner without like proper consultation with both interagency partners and external allies is a terrible way to do it. But in the end, it's not totally clear what the strategic objective is there. And, you know, I love me some strategy in order to do stuff. But I think the other piece of this that made it surprising for me was this old quote from Mattis about how you kind of only abandon your post and only resign on principle under the most dire circumstances. It makes me kind of wonder, like, is Syria really the tip of the iceberg in where he felt like he wasn't, he had sort of lost influence with the president and that those were the dire circumstances? So more like Syria is the canary in the coal mine rather than, I don't know, the coal mine.
I think that's a great question. What do we think this means for some of Mattis's other like signature issues? And I guess the one at the front of my mind would be the national defense strategy itself. But also, I guess, I mean, certainly there are people asking what this means for other critical alliances. Does this mean that we are in some sort of different, you know, should the South Koreans be worried, you know, this morning?
On the defense strategy, I'm of two minds about this because I think there's pretty decent bipartisan consensus around the very, very basic parameters and priorities in the defense strategy. What I don't think there's agreement on at all, and that I think Trump honestly is clearly all over the place on this, is the resourcing of it. What we, I think 2 weeks ago, the president, sorry, more than that, a month ago, the president decided to cut the defense budget. 2 weeks ago, it went back up higher again. I think in the absence of Mattis, I think you could see more fluctuation on this since Mattis was one of the key people to actually persuade the president, no, you need to bump it back up.
And in particular, with Mick Mulvaney being dual-hatted, he's now both OMB director and White House chief of staff.
Future Secretary of Defense, Mick Mulvaney.
Potentially. He's not going to advocate highly for a really high defense top line. So, you know, the president's budget, Mattis has announced that he's going to stay through the end of February, and the president's budget usually comes in early February. It's definitely not clear who's going to be, you know, the real strong advocate for this on the Hill, given that we know we're going to have a bit of a fight because the Democrats are taking over the House and the incoming chairman of the House Armed Services Committee has said that he wants to take the top line down.
I'm more interested about what happens in Korea, because that is a real, like, that's on the calendar effectively, at least sort of, that we are going to have some kind of summit with North Korea sometime in early 2019. And the North Koreans would love to have on the table withdrawal or some kind of limitation of U.S. forces. And that's something the president has loved in terms of an option.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see sort of what we get in terms of leadership at the top. Look, in some senses, you know, we got a Mike Pompeo instead of Rex Tillerson at the State Department, who is not like totally in line with the president's idea, but seems to be much more sort of towing the party line, especially externally, and sort of willing to take it in the chin when the president gives it. But then you do have, you know, Gina Haspel on the agency side, right, who basically went to the Hill and gave a briefing on that directly contradicted things the president said. So I think the speculation is we get a defense secretary who kind of does and says whatever Trump wants, but it's not entirely clear to me that that is the direction he might necessarily go. And you could get someone who has a more narrow scope battles they pick, and maybe it's, you know, not having a complete withdrawal from the Korean Peninsula, which feels like a pretty reasonable line for a secretary of defense to feel like he might draw. And comes up with something that resonates better with the president on maintaining troops and forces. I do think you're going to see less investment in our allies and less efforts to reassure them from whoever comes in than from Mattis, given that that's clear that that was the point of contention between Mattis and the president.
One of the things that keeps coming back to my mind is this idea that, so one, there's kind of the like domestic politics and bureaucratic politics pieces of how hard the president's advisors have worked to keep him boxed in over the last 2 years, right? Whether it was McMaster on Afghanistan or everyone on NATO, there's a clear public divergence between what the president says, for example, at his rallies or left to his own devices, and the policies that the, you know, professional bureaucracies generate for him to support and pursue. On the other hand, you know, with Mattis's departure, like, the patina has just completely worn off, right? There's no face of legitimacy. There's no, I hate this phrase, adults in the room, but like, there's no air of, you know, credibility to lend to these policies. And so, you know, Tom Wright has a piece out that's, you know, almost apocalyptic in its predictions in terms of how unhinged the president is and how there's no one there to box him in. On the other hand, there's no one there to lend credibility to those pursuits. Right. There's no H.R. McMaster. There's no war hero. There's just you know, Pompeo and Bolton, which most Americans couldn't pick out of a lineup. And they, I don't think that they care a thing, care a whit, you know, what they believe or support in terms of the president's policies. So on the one hand, yes, the president is unhinged and the imperial presidency unchecked is really quite still powerful. On the other hand, I don't know who's there to like whip Americans into supporting of a dramatic change in some of these policies.
It's not clear to me that Americans really care, though, right? I think that's the problem. And like, elections have consequences. And if the consequences are abandonment of our allies, but Americans feel like, or and by Americans, I really mean Trump's base, right? That's really what we're talking about.
Well, I think Americans could be made to care. I mean, there's a really big difference between like no longer supporting the YPG, irregular, you know, opposition group in Syria who's actually linked to a designated terrorist organization versus abandoning a longstanding treaty ally in South Korea. I think even the American public can make that distinction, but it's going to require other people to help them get to that conclusion, which kind of gets back to like, what's Congress going to do about all of this? And, you know, what level of, you know, what are the other branches of government able to do to influence these things going forward?
So one thing I've been kind of worried about or maybe admonishing myself about is the theory for the hashtag resistance folks is that by surrounding the president with folks like, I guess, originally Tillerson and Mattis and the McMaster and others who did not agree with him on most of his policy priorities, that you were doing better for the country in some way. But I have this tiny little voice in my head that wonders, like, if you'd had a cabinet and an NSC that was trying to implement the president's policies effectively and thoughtfully and without this, you know, great massive changes that the president kind of goes about really dramatically via tweet, would that actually be better and safer from a national security perspective?
Like if all of like Stephen Miller's frat brothers from Duke were like in the cabinet somehow?
I mean, if all Stephen Miller's frat brothers from Duke were actually a lot smarter and in the cabinet somehow. So like if you wanted to pull out of Afghanistan and Syria, that you did so thoughtfully and with plans. If you really thought that NATO sucked, like how do you kind of really seriously change U.S. participation in NATO? I don't think these are good policies, but I wonder if it'd be better to like spend a lot more energy thinking about how do we do this without kind of freaking everybody out versus spending a lot of time trying to prevent for the president from actually doing so.
It's certainly the way that he casted Mattis as a Secretary of Defense. And I say cast as opposed to hire or appoint because he just liked him because he looked the part, disregarding any of the like really serious and profound policy and, you know, perceptual disagreements. I think it's a great question. And I don't know that it's one that anyone's really spent a lot of time thinking about.
Well, I think just returning to Aaron's point, and maybe this is a sort of transition point to us to talk about the building as well at the Pentagon and sort of and who's kind of minding the shop there, which is running a process kind of by its nature is not a like Trump thing. And to Aaron's point, you know, if you're not having point A and point B, or Lauren's point earlier, point A and point B arguments to the president, then having an interagency process that develops a nuanced plan for staged withdrawal that's consistent with our sort of longer term objectives is probably not going to meet the president's intent. So it's just not clear to me that there is a process that is consistent with implementing the president's air quotes policies / tweets.
As a reminder, we do not have a deputy national security advisor right now. And have not in a while.
Or an attorney general, in case anybody was watching. Really. Rod, so you raise an interesting point. Like, who do we think is minding the store? So obviously we said that Mattis is in the seat until the end of February. It could take a while, potentially, to get an agreement. You know, some of these appointments took a long time the first time through. So even if there's a gap, you kind of, who's minding the store at the Pentagon in the intervening months?
So at the top, you have Deputy Secretary of Defense Pat Shanahan, as well as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, though he's effectively on his way out. And to the degree that his relationship with the president has soured over exactly these issues, I think is really an interesting speculation to have about, like, is Dunford himself also leaning towards, if not resignation, then just like, I'm done with you guys, peace out. You also have, obviously, Undersecretary of Defense John Rood. He was runs the policy shop. And from there, honestly, policy's kind of emptied out in a large way. You have your service secretaries. Heather Wilson was, we all theorized she was going to be fired at some point in time. Secretary of the Army, Mark Esper, which when's the last time you heard about him doing anything?
No.
And then Secretary of the Navy, Richard Spencer, who I should note is a theorized candidate to be the new Secretary of Defense.
I will note that, of course, you do have a fully staffed joint staff.
Oh, really? Tell us more.
they can continue to carry the water from the Pentagon in a totally not in any way concerning dismantling of civilian military processes inside the building.
Well, in some ways, that's part of the answer to Lauren's previous question. Like, part of the reason why there's many reasons why there was not an effective, thoughtful pursuit of the president's stated policies, one of which is that the uniformed military was opposed to most of them. One of which was that OSD policy was so slow to become populated. And honestly, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy is a little bit weak by historical standards. So that really the building's been run by the Joint Staff for, you know, the last couple of years. And the Joint Staff, you know, is a very powerful organization, but it is a single-minded organization. Like, it's not OSD policy. It's not linked in the same ways into the interagency process. The State Department, of course, meanwhile, has been completely neutered. And that happened under Tillerson. It honestly happened, but well before that, but it was accelerated dramatically. So yeah, we basically, I mean, maybe the foreign policy is not being run from Tampa anymore, but foreign policy is being run by the Joint Staff, and they're having a time with it, but they are not set up to serve the political needs of a political president. Certainly not when they are dramatically different from the policies we've pursued for the last, you know, many years.
So my question is, who else is going to leave?
I think it's a good question. I mean, I think Dunford has to be at the top of that list, but the question mark that almost creates its own weird separate, you know, Civ Milk crisis. And then, like, how bad do you feel for Millie?
Yeah. So actually, technically, if Dunford leaves and if Selva also leaves, the president can appoint Millie as acting chairman. Any of the joint
chiefs.
But
then can he become chairman? And does that count as his term?
No. Then you'd have to get into, like, acting versus performing the duties of issues that I just need, like, a really nerdy lawyer to get into. But just as a matter of process, the president can, if he doesn't have a chairman or a vice chairman, the next person he would appoint is a within a pool of one of the joint chiefs. He'd have to go to them.
But if Dunford left on his own, would Selva fleet up?
Yes. If Dunford left on his own, it would automatically go to Selva.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't seem like Shanahan would leave, because it seems like Shanahan, we'll get to this in just a second maybe, but is, like, certainly kind of at the top of the list for likely replacements. So his incentive is just to, like, steady as she goes, yeah, remain in place.
I'm curious if Mattis went to any of the people that he personally brought on. Those are mostly DASDs and assistant secretary level folks across the department, and said, either stay because this is important, or get the hell out of Dodge, guys. It's time to go. Seems unlikely that he'd say the second, but I don't know. Also seemed unlikely that he would resign in these circumstances too.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And it will be interesting to see if OSD policy either kind of beefs up with the new secretary, who has people that he or she, most likely he, wants to bring in. But also if, you know, folks like John Rudin, the few assistant secretaries that are still there, actually kind of stick through the Mattis transition as the department potentially moves towards being more consistent with the president's views, which is not consistent with our traditional OSD policy sort of views.
So who might get the job?
Yeah. I mean, so there's an interesting range of options here, I guess. We just mentioned Shanahan. The other one that's kind of in the mix, and Spencer, who's the Secretary of the Navy, which would be a little bit mind blowing. Dan Coats was a name that was floated, which hadn't occurred to me, but is definitely in the, like, elder statesman, steady hand model.
Inoffensive.
Yeah.
I mean, has not, like,
easily confirmable, I would
very
think,
easily confirmable.
You know, for the most part.
The opposite end, Tom Cotton.
Oh my God. Yes. And I think that affects Lauren's question, right? So part of the question about, like, who leaves is about, like, yeah, did a grown-up get this job, or did Tom Cotton? You know, Lindsey Graham used to be in this conversation. You know, if you asked me 3 months ago, I would say that Lindsey Graham is, like, clearly auditioning for the job. He, on the other hand, either seemed to see the writing on the wall or decided to fall on his sword over the Khashoggi affair. And I really don't think that he is likely, although he's, of course, completely confirmable because it comes out of the Senate. But,
well, he's been tweeting at the president recently. So did you tweet at me, sir? He's been, you know, going, yeah, no holds barred up against this administration, those tweets.
I saw something about floating sort of Secretary Wilson, Heather Wilson. That seems unlikely to me, given
weird,
you know.
But, you know, we do seem to have moved away from the appointing generals to all of the retired generals to all of these various positions.
Well, so I have heard Jack Keane.
Yeah.
Jack Keane's name is in the ring. Although, given kind of what a Iran hawk and neocon he is, that seems, I would be very surprised if that were to happen. But we are in the realm of surprising, right? We are off the equilibrium path. We are, all of my priors have been upended. I no longer have a real sense of like what we're doing here. I mean, so if you told me, you know, there's like any number of people.
Wes Clark.
Oh God.
He's waiting. Waiting in the wings.
David McCormick is in on one of these lists, who's friends with Jovanka and is the fiance of Dina Powell, you know, so there's certainly a set of like, you know, other folks. He's a West Point grad, you know, so maybe that's, you know, a thing. I mean, I don't know why any of these people would want this job at this point, to be honest. I mean, you either have to be a zealot, you know, in a sort of a Stephen Miller sort of mold for the president's expressed foreign policy vision, but I don't, it'd be really hard to want to sign up to be, you know, continue to be the brakes in the Trump administration, because he's kind of past that point, it seems like. So, I don't know. Do we have any other parting thoughts before we wrap up this little bomblet?
What do you think is on Mattis's bucket list?
Cuba. I bet he'd love to go to Cuba.
Why not?
You know, now that he's, you know, get rid of his clearances and just go, you know, have a few cigars and drive some old cars or something.
Yeah, probably instead of a mug, we should send him like a flask or a bombshell shaker or something. The
maybe
man deserves
maybe he's going to go find the fighter pilot bar somewhere in the Pentagon and just have a good old time.
That'd be great.
Yep.
All right. Please forgive any of our audio challenges or flubs. We are going to give this a light edit, so it's a down and dirty emergency podcast. And we thank you for joining us. We'll see you all in a few weeks.